for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, where are we going here now with regard to Iran? This is starting to get very, very spooky out there. George Bush speaking today before the American Enterprise Institute. Yesterday, his press conference. He's quite sure. He's certain, in fact, that Iran is up to no good in Iraq. Well, gee, if China had invaded the United States and we had asked Mexico to help us out, well, maybe it's an imperfect analogy, but in any case, here's this Cheryl Gay Stolberg in today's New York Times. Just out, President Bush said yesterday he was certain that factions within the Iranian government had supplied Shiite militants in Iraq with deadly roadside bombs that had killed American troops. You will recall, he has a very singular view of this whole thing.
This nation is at war with Islamic fascists who will use any means to destroy those of us who love freedom.
Yeah. Mr. Bush's remarks, that was not his comment from yesterday. That's from several months ago. But that's the nub of the issue, isn't it? It's these Islamic fascists. What about the corporate fascists? Chalmers Johnson has a great new book out called Nemesis. He's suggesting that America's economy now, and he's not the first to say this, by the way. Kevin Phillips' last book suggested something very similar, that America's economy, to a large part right now, and arguably for the last 30 years, but now more than ever, the bubblegum and rubber bands that are holding the thing together is being in perpetual war. And certainly if you want to eviscerate the Constitution, as Bush is certainly doing on an ongoing basis. Well, and again, this is not even George W. Bush. There's an ideology at work here. There's an entire right-wing ideology that suggests that if we can have a perpetual war, then we can have essentially a perpetual suspension of things like habeas corpus, the Fourth Amendment right of privacy in your own home, the Fifth Amendment right of not being imprisoned, not being deprived of life or liberty without due process at law, the Sixth Amendment and Seventh Amendment and Eighth Amendment rights to a speedy trial, a trial by jury, and the right to make bail, and the injunction against cruel and unusual punishment. But they're flipping the world upside down.
And when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
See, I think that's the core of this thing. I think that in the minds of many of these folks, Fife, for example, Doug Fife, that many of these people think that peace is simply the absence of war. They don't get it. In other words, there is no positive force called peace. It's not a thing. It's not a state. War is the natural state, and every now and then you pause in war, and that's called peace. That's how they view the world. This is almost a variation on the conservative versus liberal foundational worldview of humans as evil versus humans as good. Those people who believe that humans are born evil and therefore need, as Thomas Hobbes said in Leviathan back 400 years ago, the need to have an iron fist, the iron fist of government or church to restrain their true nature from coming out. That's the fundamental conservative worldview, that government doesn't exist at the pleasure of the people, that government gives rights to the people or gives privileges to the people, but that government has to be this controlling force versus the Jeffersonian, the George Washingtonian, the James Madison worldview, the worldview that the founders of this country, the children of the Enlightenment, held, that people are broadly and generally born good and decent. There are some of us who stray from that in a variety of ways. But fundamentally, we're good and decent, and therefore the goal of government is to help us become everything we can become. I realize it sounds cliched, but I don't know a better way to say it. To realize our potential, to have safety and security in community, to backstop us. And the bunch that thinks that we're all evil, of course, thinks those guys over there are evil. Look at that. They have a different skin color. They have a different language. They have a different religion. They worship, in the minds of some of these guys, they worship a different god. And they would suggest, no, it's all the same god. But nonetheless, you know, for the monotheist, tip of the hat to the monotheists out there. But Mr. Bush's remarks, this is Cheryl Gay Stolberg and Mark Santora. Mr. Bush's remarks amounted to his most specific accusation to date that Iran was undermining security in Iraq. They appear to be a part of a concerted effort by the White House to present a clearer, more direct case that Iran was supplying the potent weapons and to push back against criticism that the intelligence used in reaching the conclusions was not credible. Michael Gordon in the New York Times. This is, you know, I am so pleased, frankly, to see that it is, you know, over the weekend there was this just unquestioning reporting. Oh, it's look at these weapons from Iran, and they've got dates on them and printing on them that they were made recently, and it must be that the Iranians are supplying the Iraq. Well, first of all, even if it's true, it represents fewer than 10% of American deaths in Iraq coming from this kind of weapon or in areas that are under Shiite control. Very rarely have our forces been doing combat with Shia in Iraq, because the Shia run the government. The Shia are saying, hey, this is our day in the sun. We were oppressed by the Sunnis, by Saddam Hussein, for years and years and years, for decades, and now it's our turn. You have a Shia prime minister. You have a majority Shia in the parliament. Al-Sadr is, you know, controls about a third of the parliament, large voting bloc. So about the only time that we've done battle with the Shia is when we pushed into their world. For example, the first surge that Bush did 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, when he went into Sadr City and tried to arrest Muqtada al-Sadr. And 5 of our soldiers were killed the first day that happened by the Mehdi army, by Sadr's soldiers. One of those 5, ironically, was Cindy Sheehan's son, Casey. But that's been the exception, not the rule. That's been, depending on whose numbers you're using, somewhere between 4 and 8% of American combat deaths in Iraq, or not just combat deaths, American deaths, American military deaths in Iraq, have happened in combat with Shia forces. The vast majority of them, Fallujah, Anbar province, all this stuff that's going on outside Baghdad and even inside Baghdad, are Sunni forces who are saying, hey, wait a minute, our territory doesn't have any oil. We used to run the country. We were the experts. We were the expert weapons makers. We were the Republican Guard. We were the elite military forces. We want our country back, they're saying. And they're fighting us. And Saudi Arabia is holding fundraisers. You've got private Saudi citizens holding fundraisers, raising tens of millions of dollars, sending it in cash to Iraq or to agents for Iraq who are buying things like shoulder-fired missiles, surface-to-air missiles, anti-aircraft missiles. And right after one of those fundraisers, relatively soon after one of those fundraisers, it was in December that the Associated Press was reporting on this, and then all of a sudden in January, late December and January, and now into February, we're seeing our helicopters being shot out of the sky. You don't shoot a helicopter out of the sky with an AK-47. So anyhow, here's Michael Gordon in the New York Times. He says, why accuse Iran of meddling now? U.S. officials explain. One of the questions posed by skeptics about the Bush administration's assertions about Iran's meddling in Iraq is why the charges are coming to light only now. When American officials say the shipment of lethal weapons from Iran to Shiite militias was first detected several years ago, among possible explanations for the timetable, some critics have suggested, is that the White House is making its assertions now in an effort to blame Iran for the deteriorating situation in Iraq. Option number one, Bush is trying to shift the blame. He's trying to say that it's not his fault. He didn't screw it up. It wasn't Rumsfeld. It's those damn Iranians, number one. Or, number two, that President Bush is trying to lay a legal and political groundwork for a military strike against the government of Tehran, which he singled out in 2002 as a member of the Axis of Evil. I would submit to you that he is trying to do both. You don't need an or there. You can have an and. These guys realize that in order to keep the American economy running, they have to have this perpetual war. So much of our spending now is being routed through the Pentagon and through these contractors. If it were to go away, our unemployment rate would be going up, our inflation rate would be going up. It'd be a mess. 16 minutes past the hour.
Why don't we liberate these United States? We're the ones who need it worse. Let the rest of the world help us for change, and let's rebuild America first. Our highways and bridges are falling apart. Who's blessed? Who has been cursed? There's things to be done all over the world, but let's rebuild America first.
You tell a Merle Haggard. I'm telling you, when Bush has lost Merle Haggard, he's lost America. In fact, I got an email from somebody the other day, said that they'd gone to a Merle Haggard concert. I guess it was up in Seattle. And he came out and he was talking about Hillary in kind of a very general way. And then he bursts into this song of Let's Put a Woman in Charge. Anyhow, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio supported by you, our listeners, listening for the sponsors on your local radio station. Vital stuff. They're the ones that keep this program and your local radio stations on the air. Listen for your sponsors. Patronize their products. Call them. Let them know you're listening. And tell your friends about them. Plus our national sponsors as well, like SacredGroundsCoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, SmallDog.com, EcoWine.com, Purina One Natural Blends, 1-866-380-MEOW. Help them out. Charlie Rangel on the House floor. Talking about this. It's a non-binding resolution. And it's an important first step.
The family actually walked me to the coffin, and my knees buckled. Why?
He's talking about a funeral, a military funeral that he attended.
Instead of seeing a brown-skinned Dominican in a Marine outfit, I saw a soldier about 20 years old in an Army uniform.
Charlie Rangel had been in the Army.
Not a Marine uniform. And guess what? He looked just like me.
In fact, as I recall, Charlie Rangel served in Italy during World War II, but I may be very wrong on that.
I asked my colleagues that this great country and this great Constitution has given you the right in your hand to determine who lives and who dies. You can't make a mistake in supporting this resolution. It's not going to hurt our beloved warriors. It's going to help our country. It's going to help them. And it's going to make us proud one day to be able to say when asked, what did you do when this was going on in the world and your Congress was asked? And you would be able to say, there was a resolution. It may not have been a profile in courage, but I supported it, and I'm proud that I did.
It's a starting point. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, tomhartman.com. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, just click live chat up at the top of the page. Ransom in Tennessee, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Ransom, what's on your mind today? Ransom. You gotta listen to your phone, not your radio there. Warren in Eugene, Oregon on KOPT. Hey, Warren, what's
Hello.
Up? Hi. You are live and on the air, sir. Hello? If Warren, if you're not hearing me, I think we've got a problem. I'm going to put you on hold, and we will try Mark in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Mark.
Hello?
Hey, Mark.
Hello?
We've got a board problem in New York. We're going to have to figure this thing out. Here are the questions that have been put forward by skeptics. This is from, according to Michael Gordon in the New York Times, by skeptics about what's going on with the Bush administration. What are they trying to do? And I just have to say, in my opinion, what we're seeing is an absolute breakdown here. This is Bush playing out his fantasy.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
And it's something that, frankly, I think we should all be very, very concerned about. very concerned about. I suppose it's possible to make light of it. Here's Stephen Colbert.
We're not so different, he and I. We both get it.
Talking about Bush.
Guys like us, we're not some brainiacs on the nerd patrol. We're not members of the Factanista. We go straight from the gut. Right, sir? That's where the truth lies. Right down here in the gut.
Yeah, right. Indeed. So this is the gut level bond has been lost. Oh, by the way, while we're at it, there has the news from Washington, D.C., from the Capitol Hill. The Wild West is emerging. Indeed, the good, Keith Ellison. The bad, Tom Tancredo. And the ugly, a cigar. Yes. Here's what Tom Tancredo had to say about this.
I got a call from somebody, your next-door neighbor, about the fact that you were smoking a cigar. And I said, what about it? And she said, well, he's complaining about it. And I said, well, that's tough.
That's tough. Yeah, Tom Tancredo, real considerate guy, smoking a cigar in his office there. He shares a wall with Representative Keith Ellison, the congressman who stirred up such a fuss among right-wingers by wanting to be photo-opped, sworn in, with his hand on the Koran, the first Muslim to be in the House of Representatives. And as the Hill says, apparently the freshman lawmaker doesn't believe it's Representative Tom Tancredo's right to smoke a cigar in his congressional office. I don't know what the law is on this. This article doesn't say. Sharing offices next door. On the one hand, Tancredo says, hey, you know, why didn't he come over and say something? He should have, you know, but good manners. On the other hand, Tancredo is saying, tough luck. That's bad manners, too. So what Ellison really should have done was gone over and asked him the old Freud question, you know, 27 minutes past the hour. Oh, baby. Ferrets slightly unbalanced. Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. The Bush conference, press conference yesterday, positively spooky. There was one point that really and truly amazed me. Just to wrap this up, and then we have fixed the phone lines in New York, and I will be taking your calls in just a second. But this really and truly amazed me. Can you imagine if Bill Clinton, in a news conference, was asked about Monica Lewinsky, and he simply said, I'm not going to discuss that? Do you think that the reporter would have shut up and sat down, and that no reporters would have said, follow up on that, sir, and that nobody would have brought it up with the press secretary the following day? I mean, just think about it for a minute. What would have happened? What did happen? Listen to this question that was asked of Bush yesterday. Now, first of all, keep in mind, back when Valerie Plame was first outed, an entire CIA operation all over the world, Brewster Jennings, was brought down, and people may have been killed as a result of this, and we certainly lost access to intelligence. This is the worst kind of treason, according to Bush Sr. Bush Jr. was asked about it, and he said, A, he was going to find out who it was, or if he found out who it was, he was going to fire them. But B, he really didn't think he'd find them, you know, after all.
And I don't know if we're going to find out. The senior administration official, now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
So yesterday, a reporter asks him point blank if it was him.
Sir, we've now learned through sworn testimony that at least three members of your administration, other than Scooter Libby, leaked Valerie Plame's identity to the media. None of these three is known to be under investigation. Without commenting on the Libby file, then, can you tell us whether you authorized any of these three?
Whether you authorized any of these three? Did you, Mr. Bush?
Did they authorize without your permission?
Yeah, thanks, Pete. I'm not going to talk about any of it.
They're not under investigation, though, sir.
Peter, not going to talk about any of it.
How about pardon, sir? Many people are asking whether you might pardon
somebody. Not going to talk about it, Peter. If you'd like to think of another question, being the kind man that I am, I will recycle you. John.
Now, you think Bill Clinton could have gotten away with that? Monica Lewinsky? Sex in the White House? No, not going to talk about it. We're talking here about breaking federal law, the possible death of CIA officers and agents, the compromising of U.S. intelligence, all for political revenge. Amazing. Tim in Thousand Oaks, California. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm delighted that you're on, Tom. I've been a supporter of yours for years.
Thank you.
It's just amazing that the so-called mainstream media, the gutless press, never asks one question about oil contracts, about permanent bases, about all the underlying causes for the war. They just throw softballs at this guy every time there's a press conference or a press briefing. Nobody
I would submit to you that the reason for that, Tim, is that the large multinational corporations that the vast majority of these reporters are working for, certainly the ones that Bush will call on, have many of the same interests of the Bush administration. They're making a pile of money off this war, whether they're making it through you know, hey, you know, getting more eyeballs on TV. Oh, boy, war, it drives up ratings. Or whether it's because they also happen to be defense contractors or they have, you know, investments or they have interlocking boards with defense contractors. We have in the United States now, we have been on a permanent war footing for the better part of 60 years, 50 years anyway. And our economy right now, if you were to take out the $500 billion that's been spent but over the last 5 years, last 4.5 years on the war in Iraq, if you were to take that money out, because so much of it has cycled back to the United States because it's going through the big contractors, you take that money out of our economy and take the jobs that that has created out of our economy, manufacturing goods for the military, all that kind of thing, we would still be in the recession of 2001 that was the result of the initial Bush tax cuts.
You know, when I was in media and radio 30 years ago, I worked for Westinghouse Broadcasting in and it's really interesting how times have changed, because at that time they took some of their top-rated music stations and converted them to all news stations as a public service because they wanted to curry favor with the government and look like good guys in order to get government contracts. They were willing to create top-rated.
Well, it wasn't just that, Tim. I mean, maybe it was with Westinghouse, I don't know, but I can tell you, you know, 30 years ago, I was working in radio news as well, and you know, I remember well that the radio station that I worked at, stations, but you know, the one that I did news at for years, had to do it because the Fairness Doctrine, the laws required that in order to maintain their license, the FCC rules as well, that in order to maintain their license, they had to perform public service, and that was providing real news. And they got that news from the networks, and that's why the networks were losing money. CBS was losing money. NBC, ABC, they were losing money on their news operations, and there was a wall of separation between the news operation and the business side of it, the sales side of it. Because that was the public service that was being provided. Warren in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Warren.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Say, yesterday, somebody asked Bush if there was any assurances the public could believe the weapons intel from Iran.
Right.
And his response was that was a preposterous question. So I just want you to know that the UN's weapons inspectors have a site open to the public for, you know, address, phone numbers, email, everything. If people want to ask them to verify Bush's claims on weapons in Iran, they can contact UNMOVIC, United Nations Monitoring Verification Inspection Commission.
.org? Don't know.
Wait, I don't know if there's a...
Yeah, if you can find
UN,
it.
UN.org, yes. It's UN. If you Google UNMOVIC...
No, I just typed it in. I just www.unmovic.org, and there I am. UN, the United Nations Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission. Fascinating.
Yeah,
Warren, thanks a lot for the heads up. I'll spend some time there and track it down. Mark in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Mark.
Hi. You had a question the last few days about American weapons in Iran being used by the Shiite militias against Americans, and you wondered where that possibly could happen?
No, we know that it has happened. I'm not disputing that. I'm saying if you're talking about the Shia, you know, the majority of our combat has been with Sunnis, not Shia.
Right. But the way that the Iranians could have given it to them, we supplied weapons to Iran under the Shah for 25 years.
Oh, sure, of course. We're still supplying, we're still selling weapons to Iran. We're just doing it through international arms dealers. That was the big scandal from 2 weeks ago, that F-14 parts, millions of dollars worth of F-14 parts, are making their way to Iran from the United States because people are buying them off U.S. defense websites.
Right. And
Iran, it's like a giant eBay sale.
Yeah, Iran-Contra is my where I believe is where this all came from, and that's why the administration really doesn't want to go into it, because I was in the Gulf at the time. The American weapons were actually turned around and threatened against American forces, and that's probably where this comes from, because we supplied them through Iran-Contra with artillery, explosives, Hawk missile parts, F-14 parts, and it affected U.S. military operations escorting tankers in the Persian Gulf.
Yeah, good point. Mark, thank you very much. David in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hey, David.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just want to make a comment about your discussion earlier with regard to, I think you were trying to talk about realism versus liberalism. But,
no, I would say conservatism versus realism.
If you're saying
that Thomas Hobbes' view was realistic and John Locke's view was unrealistic, then the United States has existed for 230 years in an unrealistic state. And we're just now phasing into a realistic state as we give up our constitutional rights.
But for you to say that somehow our founding fathers didn't take into account, everything is based upon Hobbes' concept of the natural state.
And not true. Absolutely not true. The founders refuted Hobbes. The founders disputed Hobbes. The founders were fond of John Locke and Rousseau. They were of the Enlightenment. Hobbes was the conservative contrarian. And no, absolutely not true. Go back and read Jefferson. Read Franklin. Read George Washington's comments, most of which were ghostwritten by James Madison.
Okay, James Madison, Federalist number 1051, talking about self-interest as a great protector of our democracy. And self-interest is the basis of what I think Hobbes is talking about. And moreover, Locke, Rousseau, Voltaire, all of them believe in the social contract.
Sure, absolutely.
The basis of which is Hobbes' concept of a perpetual state of war between men without an authority or a social contract.
Not true. The Enlightenment view of the social contract is that we're all in this together. We're here to support each other. That the purpose of government is to backstop us. Hobbes' view of government is that we're not all in this together. We're all competing with each other. It's every man for himself. That we're born hateful and angry and violent, and that the purpose of government is not to backstop us, but to restrain us.
And so you would argue that Madison and Hamilton felt that we were all looking out for each other, and that it wasn't an issue of interest working against each other. But
Madison, yes. So. Hamilton, no. Hamilton was more of a conservative. Hamilton, you know, arguably was more on Hobbes' side. But I'd say the majority of the founders, certainly the ones who prevailed, and that's why the Constitution is written the way it is. It's why all power is given to the people. And then they reiterate it in the 9th and 10th Amendments of the Constitution. All power is not reserved by the government or given in the 9th Amendment to the states and the 10th Amendment to the people. They were absolutely saying, we can trust everybody. We can trust. John Adams didn't like it. He was one of the conservatives. He was on Hobbes' side. He said, yeah, that's the rabble. But all the rest of them, yeah. 45 minutes past the hour.
There's a dark and a troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side too. Though we meet with the darkness and strife, the sunny side we also may view.
And welcome back to the radio support group of by and for We the People of the United States of America. Charlie Rangel, just a correction, I thought he'd served in Italy. I was mixing him up with somebody else. He was a decorated Army combat vet. He served in Korea. And as I recall, won the Bronze Star I thought I had it here, but apparently not. Anyhow, it's Charlie Rangel. He served in Korea. 1-866-440-THOMR, telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Rami in Bakersfield, California. Hey, Rami, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, I'm thinking that perhaps these these Iranian IEDs, I mean, could be coming in from Iran, but they could actually be coming in from, like, rogue elements within the Iranian military, like rogue generals, who, I mean, in turn are hoping to provoke an attack upon Iran so they can watch the government get removed from there and so they can move in and take over because, I mean, we always hear about, like, how the Iranian population is tired of the clerics and the old ways and supporting the revolution of 79. So,
At a certain level, it really doesn't matter. I mean, at a certain level, it really doesn't matter because we're fighting against people who don't want us in their country.
Yes.
And, you know, those people are going to go wherever they can to get help. Obviously, they're getting help from Saudi Arabia. We know that they're getting help from people in Jordan. We know that they're getting help from people in other Gulf states. It should be no surprise that they're getting help from people in Iran. These, you know, it's like, hey, we're in the neighborhood. We're your friends. We'll help you out in some way. We shouldn't be there. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Right.
And it's really the beginning and the end of it. Rami, thank you very much. Good point. Ransom in Tennessee. It's working now, Ransom. What's up?
Yes, good show, Professor. I had
three
good quick points I wanted to make about that first clip of George Bush.
Yes.
First comment, shouldn't we be more concerned and afraid of the Christian fascists here in the U.S. that are blowing up our buildings instead of Islamic fascists overseas? Secondly, if they really do hate our freedoms, if they really do hate freedom, how come they're not attacking countries like Holland and Sweden, which has more freedom than us? And the third point is, since if China were to solve the North Korea problem, then Iran will be the only member of the Axis of Evil left, and that's not much of an axis. They'd probably be more like the Sittenstein of evil.
There you go. Good points, Ransom. Excellent points. But your first point again was?
My first point was we've got Christian fascists.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Here
in the U.S.
That are more of a threat to us than Islamic fascists.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for the reminder. It's a good point. Tim McVeigh thought that he was going to create an uprising. He thought that the good white wasp Christians all across the United States were going to rise up. When on the second anniversary after the Waco bombing, he blew up the federal building in Oklahoma. He really believed that. He had been reading the Turner Diaries. It's a novel in which a white Christian terrorist blows up a federal building, as I recall, in Oklahoma City. I actually, back when it happened, went out and got a copy of the Turner Diaries and read it. And this guy blows up this building, and the government responds by becoming hyper-repressive. They pass laws allowing them to sneak into people's homes and look at their papers. They start taking people's guns. They do away with habeas corpus, the federal government. They start disappearing people. They throw people in jail without right of trial or without charges. They take people to foreign countries to torture them. I mean, all this stuff happened in the Turner Diaries as the result of this. And the good white gun-toting Christians of America realize that the government has become too repressive, and they rise up and they kill off all the people of color, all the Jews, all the Catholics, and all the government employees. And what's left standing at the end of the novel in the Turner Diaries is this new government of white Anglo-Saxon born-again Protestants. And that's what Tim McVeigh thought he was going to bring about. He thought there would be such a hyper response from Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton would declare war on the Christians in America as a result of his blowing up the federal building. That it would lead to that. And there have been dozens, perhaps hundreds, of people arrested around the United States over the last 15 years with huge caches of weapons. People who are genuine terrorists, and we've had a whole series of acts of terrorism. I was living in Atlanta when a guy blew up another one of these guys. A guy who, you know, ended up blowing up a gay bar later on, you know, a couple days later, blew up the Olympics. I mean, you know, it's, yes. We should be concerned about this. Jack in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Jack.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm just great.
What's up? My point is that how anybody could believe anything Bush says about where these IEDs are coming from is completely insane.
Especially when he says, basically, well, you're just going to have to trust me on this. I mean, this is where it gets really and truly scary, is Bush just saying, you know, this is true because I said it's true. And
yeah, right. The way he was acting at that press conference was almost like a madman, just like shuffling around and bobbing his head and giggling.
Yeah. No, it's the war insanity.
It's hard for me in the, you know, living in the this beautiful White House to give you an assessment, a first-hand assessment. I haven't been there. You have. I haven't.
Yeah. I don't have any idea what's going on. Jack, thank you for the call. Well said. And I just live here in the White House. I don't know what's going on. Oh, man. It would be funny if it weren't so tragic. It would be funny if there weren't people dying. And not just Americans. I mean, it's time for us to start talking about the human race once in a while. 57 minutes past the hour. The Employee Free Choice Act. What's up with this? Can we revive labor in the United States? We're going to have two discussions, two different points of view on the topic right after the break. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
So what kind of rights should workers have in the United States of America? Do we have an economy for the workers? Do we have an economy for the owners? Does society exist to serve the economy? Does business exist to serve society? Or is there something in between there? Ivan Osorio is with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. CEI.org is their website. He's a labor policy analyst. Ivan, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
We have a piece of legislation here, the Employee Free Choice Act, which is being put forward. A number of people sponsoring this. I guess Mr. Miller, Congressman George Miller, the Democrat from California, is the one who's the primary sponsor of it, if my information is correct.
Yes.
And basically it's going to allow for card checks, something that the AFL-CIO has been pushing really hard for a long, long time, where if somebody wants to join a union, they just check off on a card and say, yeah, I want to join a union, whereas right now, and I can tell you from personal experience, although, frankly, there hasn't been any anti-union activity where I work. I work at a Clear Channel radio station, but I'm a member of AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio, whatever it is. So I'm a union member. And the whole voting thing can be a real challenge. I mean, it hasn't been, as I said, it hasn't been here at Clear Channel, but I hear horror stories from people in other places where, well, here, workers are fired in a quarter of private sector union organizing campaigns. 78% of private employers require supervisors to deliver anti-union messages to their workers whose jobs and pay they control. And even after workers successfully form a union, they can't get a contract a third of the time. Why not fix a broken system?
Well, it's not a broken system, and here's why. As a matter of fact, the Employee Free Choice Act would break a very important component of that, which is the secret ballot. I mean, right now it's already illegal for, you know, employers to intimidate or threaten employees. Of course, I'm not saying they don't do that. I mean, that's a question of enforcement.
Well, the problem is that starting with the Reagan administration, they've been interpreting harass and intimidate in ways that mean something like, well, you know, if you take one of your workers and string them up by one arm and hit them with tasers repeatedly, that's illegal. But if you threaten to fire them or if you require them to sit through these, I mean, there's a whole industry, as you well know, of people who go into companies and do workshops with the employees to tell them how evil unions are.
Well, now, Tom, now, on your second point right there, let me make a point there. I mean, now, also, I mean, the unions will also tend to interpret harassment as being another case. Now, would you say that employers don't have a right to make their case as well as the union? I mean it's a two-way dialogue here.
Employer controls all the power. In a non-union shop, the power relationship is totally disproportionate.
So do the only thing, speak act?
No, I'm not suggesting that, but what I'm saying is that there should be some proportionality to that power. The only thing that a worker has is the ability to withhold their work. That's it. The ability to strike is the only thing that a worker has. The employer can offer more or less health benefits, more or greater or less vacation benefits, higher or lower pay, different working conditions, a million things that they can offer or they can withhold. The only thing that the employee has is I'm going to show up or I'm not going to show up. And ultimately, you know, that's in a non-union shop, the employee doesn't even have that, because if they don't show up, they don't have a job.
Well, if you don't show up for work, you should be fired. I mean, I'm not.
Well, I'm talking about a strike.
Pardon?
I'm talking about a strike. I'm saying that the only power workers have is the power to withhold their labor, and they can only exercise that power in an environment where they're unionized. And employers have all these powers. And, yeah, sure, they should be able to make their case, but they shouldn't be able to fire, I mean, employees for trying to organize, as happens in the United States in constantly, you know, in about a third of cases. They shouldn't have the power to force employees to sit through these long things on company time. You know, it's just the system right now. What's wrong with Karczyk? What's wrong with just saying, here, you guys, you want to join a union? Yes or no?
Because it's not out in the open, and this is the thing. Now of course, and here's a lot of the rhetoric coming out of the AFL-CIO. When you sign a card, you're doing it out in the open.
What's wrong with that? We used to do elections out in the open. I mean, we've only had secret ballot elections in the United States since the 1870s.
But the vote itself is secret. I mean, that when all is said and done, once the campaigning organizing is over, whether it's successful or not, each individual employee, you know, he or she knows how she voted. Whereas, if you sign a card out in public, I mean, you're actually assigning your signature to something. Both the employer and the union know what, you know, basically allows them to, you know, segregate, the workers went to, like, allies or foes, you know, depending how hostile, you know, they decide they want to be. But it's that secret ballot. Now, one other thing too about the Employee Free Choice Act, if it's so cumbersome, if these secret ballots are so cumbersome, why don't do away with them altogether? Because the Employee Free Choice Act is going to keep them for decertification elections,
what this ultimately comes down to, though, we're talking with Ivan Osorio. He's a labor policy analyst at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, conservative think tank. What this ultimately really comes down to is that there is a concerted effort on the part of business and by think tanks like yours to do away with unions. I mean, ultimately, you would like to see a world where there aren't unions, right?
No, that is not the case at all. I mean,
where unions are essentially powerless.
No, where unions don't have a world in which unions don't. I would like to see a world in which unions don't remain viable. Don't have to resort to the power of government.
But that's not going to happen. That's not possible. It's only by virtue of the power of government that a union can exist, because otherwise the employers hold so much power that the employees can't. I mean, employees were trying to form unions, and they were trying to strike, and it wasn't until 1935 with the Wagner Act that we saw employees actually have the legal right to form a union. And prior to that, I mean, you had employers hiring, you know, Pinkerton, I believe, I may be wrong on the name, but, you know, several of our security firms services today were originally goon squads that in some cases killed strikers.
Yeah, well, that should be illegal. But the reason we can argue, and we're not going to come to a conclusion whether unions are possible with government or not, is because it hasn't been tried in so long that, you know, ever since the passing of the Wagner Act, basically, you know, government has managed labor so closely that we really don't know what it would look like. And as far as forming unions, it's in the
country. Well, we can look at the previous 7,000 years.
Pardon?
You can look at the previous 7,000 years. The only groups that had decent pay, even during the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages, were the, for example, the Masons, those who formed guilds, which were essentially unions.
Yeah, the guilds were also, they're also very restrictive. They actually tried to keep people from joining their profession.
Well, that's the whole point of a union, is to limit the supply of labor so you drive up the price of labor so that people can have a decent middle class life.
So you're saying you're in favor of restricting entry into a profession and fixing
yes.
and price fixing?
What I am saying is I am in favor of unions using their position to try to limit the availability of labor to employers. Yes, because it's the only way in a universe where employers, particularly where we have now, where employers are relatively free to hire anybody from any country they want, whether it's through a visa program or hiring people who are here illegally on any basis, or to go to countries where repressive, violent dictatorships like China will force people to work, as long as corporations can do that, then the price of labor just falls through the floor. We've been watching this go on for 26 years, ever since Ronald Reagan declared war on organized labor and on the working people of America. Yes. The history, the progressive history of the labor movement has been always to try to limit the supply of labor. That's why we had child labor laws, so the kids wouldn't compete with adults.
Okay. Well, but how about saying so you're essentially saying you're for a different standard for labor as for business. You know, like
that's
unions
right.
should be allowed to do things that business isn't allowed to do.
That's right. But there's a vice versa to that. There's a whole bunch of things businesses can do that labor can't do. I mean, we by law limit the liability of stockholders and directors. You know, limited liability corporations called that for a reason. We're giving all kinds of benefits to corporations. We're giving them access to a court system that all of us are paying for with our taxes. We're giving them a stable currency. We're giving them an educated workforce. We're providing infrastructure from sewers to roads.
You're saying only corporations benefit for a stable currency?
No, I'm not saying only, but I'm saying we're
so do you.
We're sure, but I'm saying they benefit from that your point made. They benefit okay. from it. That's a tax argument. Actually, that's my argument for why they should pay 50% of the tax load, and they're only paying 6% right now in the United States, or 7%. But anyhow, as you said, Ivan, we're not going to solve this problem tomorrow. I appreciate you coming on and talking with me about it. Yep. Ivan Osorio, he's a labor policy analyst with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Do good, Ivan.
No, thank you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take your kids to the seashore. It ain't
and welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour on the radio support group of By and For We, the people of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman program. Our number 1-866-440-THOM. That's going to change on Monday, by the way. And TomHartman.com, our website, that will not change. AFL-CIO Director of Organizing, Stuart Acuff, on the line with us. AFL-CIO.org is the website. Stuart, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. Also, EmployeeFreeChoiceAct.org, another website that goes right to this issue. We were just talking with a representative of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, one of the conservative think tanks, saying this is just a terrible, terrible idea, this card check thing, that people should have, that it should be easy to join a union, essentially. And the argument that these guys always toss out is that it's not a secret ballot. Take a shot at that.
Well, workers would still have a chance to vote in an election if that's what they wanted. If 30% signed cards and petitioned the National Labor Relations Board for an election, they could get an election. So the Employee Free Choice Act does not do away with any elections. But more importantly, they talk about secret ballot elections as if there is any similarity between a National Labor Relations Board election process and our political elections. There is not. The National Labor Relations Board election process is rife with retaliation, with intimidation, with firings. One out of five union activists can expect to be fired in an organizing campaign. 31,000 workers in America were discriminated against, fired, or suspended last year for union activity.
Last year, over
20,000 workers in America have been retaliated against, fired, or suspended each of the last 15 years for union activity. The fact of the matter is that it is now ingrained in American corrupt corporate culture to do anything to prevent workers from forming a union.
There's an entire industry. There are companies out there whose only job is to come into a corporation where there might be a union forming and prevent it from happening.
That's right. It's a $4 billion a year industry now, Tom. And to counsel illegality, to counsel unethical behavior. 50% of all campaigns where workers are trying to form a union, the employer threatens to shut down the facility. 25 to 30% of all employer campaigns, the union campaigns, the employer fires the union leaders. It's a tragedy. It's a national disgrace. And that,
so why card check as a response to that? Why not just go after, repeal Taft-Hartley and let's go back to the Wagner Act?
Because we believe in America and free association. And we believe that people ought to be able to join the Boy Scouts, the Cub Scouts, the Elks Lodge, the Moose Lodge, by signing a card and paying dues. And that's the way it ought to be to join a union. Sign a card, pay dues. If more than 50% in a work site sign a card, then the union is recognized. This would greatly streamline the process. More importantly, Tom, and here's the real point, it would allow American workers to once again bargain for inclusion in the middle class and bargain for a piece of the American dream. And that is what is really at stake. That's what's been challenged over these last 20 years of these corporate assaults on workers and American unions. And that's why George Miller and the House Education and Labor Committee have said a cornerstone of strengthening the middle class, expanding the middle class, is giving workers the right and the opportunity to bargain with their employers for a way into the middle class. If I could just say one terrible irony of this whole process is the day the Chamber of Commerce announced that they were going to fight this bill with all the might that they had, that they were going to throw everything they could at it to stop workers from bargaining their way into the middle class. It was the same day that the CEO of Home Depot was given a $218 million severance package for screwing up his job. So they're saying, CEOs can get $220 million for screwing up their job, but workers can't bargain their way into the middle class. We've gotten our values wrong here, Tom.
I agree. The big aha that I just got from what you're saying, Stuart Acuff, director of organizing at the AFL-CIO, is that we should think of unions not as political candidates, as something where it's important that we, be secret about whether we're supporting them or not, but as like you said, joining the Boy Scouts.
Right.
This is a voluntary association of individuals.
That's right.
And there's nothing wrong with holding up your hand and saying, yeah, I'm a member. I want to be a member.
Right.
Sign me up.
Right.
And what's wrong with that? I mean, we do that with a book club it's like whatever it may be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yet corporate America has done everything they can to keep American workers from accessing the middle class.
Right, and to confuse the issue, and they're tearing apart the middle class in the process of doing it. And ever since Reagan, this war, well, actually, arguably, ever since 1947 with the passage of Taft-Hartley, which we should repeal.
That's right, Tom.
That's the movement I'd really like to sign on for, is repeal Taft-Hartley. Stuart Acuff, AFL-CIO Director of Organizing, the website AFLCIO.org or Employee Free Choice Act. This is the one that's on the table right now, .org. Check it out and contact your member of Congress and tell them to support the Employee Free Choice Act. Stuart, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you. Thanks for all you do for all of us every day.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
I've seen mornings when 1,000 bales of hay look like a mountain to a boy my age. And I've seen my daddy in that hot southern sun move those mountains one by one. And I've seen that same man come home from the mill, pull 40 hours for $100 bill. I've watched him struggle, and I've watched him age, raising a family on a working man's wage. I grew up on a working man's wage.
And welcome back.
Speaking from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone here in what Bush Sr. refers to as the People's Republic of Little Beirut, Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my. Here's the good news. The Employee Free Choice Act actually has a chance of passing. There's a lot of Democrats on board with this, and even a few Republicans who'd rather get reelected in a year and a half. The bad news, Dick Cheney gave a speech a couple days ago in which he said if this thing gets passed, he'll make sure that Bush vetoes it. Amazing. Here's the history of this thing. I mean, this from Think Progress, the Center for American Progress. In October 2006, Bush's National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, easily the most anti-worker labor board in history. Keep in mind, this really started with Reagan. In 1981, that was when the middle class began to collapse seriously and rapidly as a result of conservative economic policies and labor policies. In October 2006, the NLRB, Bush's NLRB, issued a decision that they will deny the right to organize to as many as 8 million workers in 200 occupations. In 2000, 13% of all wage and salary workers were unionized. In 2006, just 12% are in unions. And that includes all the government employees. If you look at just private sector, it's gone from 23.2% when Reagan came into office, roughly 25%, roughly a quarter of workers, to 8.5% now. In 2004, 92% of employers forced workers to attend mandatory captive audience meetings where workers' offices had to listen to hours of anti-union presentations by corporate representatives. And the consequence? The median hourly wage for American workers has declined 2% since Bush came into office. What a surprise. Right. What a surprise. 1-866-440-8466 to Eric in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Eric, welcome to the program, and thanks for listening to WTKG, Clear Channel in Grand Rapids there. What's up?
Thanks, Tom. Your guest from the think tank, I think he's missing a few key points when he starts talking about unions shouldn't have to be backed up by the government. History will tell us that power structure needs an acknowledged higher power structure to keep the exercise of power in check. I mean, would he be satisfied with the general and public enforcing the laws that keep him and his property and family safe? I don't hardly think so. You've got to have some kind of a higher power that's going to keep the lower ones in check. Over the years, unions have become ineffective because they've made contract concessions to keep employers supposedly viable during the 80s when, you know, all the problems were involved.
Well, this came about as a result of three things. Number one, Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act, so corporations started getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and these huge economies of scale, they could lay off workers, and so employees were terrified. Number two, Reagan had this amnesty in 86 and basically stopped enforcing our immigration laws, so the labor force in the United States increased by millions. And number three, starting in the 80s, Reagan and then Bush Sr. and then Bill Clinton and now Bush Jr. have been pushing through all these crazed trade agreements where we've done away with tariffs that protected our domestic industries for 230 years and built America into an industrial powerhouse and shipped millions of jobs overseas, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of business overseas. And so the American workers are terrified now.
Sure. I mean, for those people who are against unions, I really think they need to sit down and think about it. You can't buy a car, you can't buy a house, you can't even go into the grocery store. You can't do anything in this society without entering into some kind of a contract of performance. You can't go into a grocery store without entering that contract of performance by admitting the fact that if you pick something up and walk out with it, you're going to have to pay for it. That's a contract.
Right.
Why should labor be any different? I mean, businesses have contracts with their suppliers, with their customers. Why shouldn't there be a contract of performance with everybody involved?
Yeah, good point, Eric. Thank you very much for the call. Well said. Mary in San Jose, California. Hey, Mary.
Hi, Tom. I have two questions. One, I work for the federal government, and we are allowed to, be part of a union. But when I was hired on, I had to sign a document saying that I would never strike. Or I would be fired. And the question was, how did that ever come into place? And then the second question I have, and then I'll just let you answer, the last AFGME news bulletin that came out mentioned that there was something in the works about federal employees having to go be enlisted and go to Iraq. And I tried to look and see if that there was any truth to that. And I wonder if you know if there is anything like that. And then
taking the second first, Mary, I don't know. I have not heard that there's going to be any effort to basically draft federal employees and ship them to Iraq. I just don't know. My guess would be that given the proclivities of this administration, they would simply suggest that the big contractors come to you and offer you more money. they seem to think that that's the way to do everything. And a non-union federal contractor, by the way. With regard to government employees not striking, the original rationale was that there are some areas, and this goes back to the railroad strikes in the 1880s, there are some areas that are so important to the functioning of civil society that people who are working in those areas should not be allowed to strike. They should be given some other powers. There should be mandatory a requirement, for example, that government has to bargain with them. And you know, there originally were some powers that were given to unions in those areas. And those areas were very narrowly circumscribed. And this was, you know, Reagan, PATCO technically broke the law when they went out on strike, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization. That they were one of those groups that was federal employees that was considered essential services, and they said, no, we're going to go on strike. And so, you know, Reagan used that to fire them and to not just fire them, but to punish them, to banish all those people permanently. In a lot of other countries, those laws don't exist. That's why you always hear about, you know, in France, the bus drivers are on strike, or the railroad, you know, the nationalized industries, the railroads are on strike, things like that. I frankly am of the opinion that government employees should be allowed to strike, and that we need a real fundamental change from the top to the bottom in our labor policies. But that was the original rationale behind those kinds of things.
When Congress doesn't approve a budget and there virtually is no money, we are forced to work as essential workers. We are forced to go to work without pay.
Even without a paycheck. And there you have basically Congress going on strike. I mean, you know, Newt Gingrich shut the government down, and you know, he didn't get punished for it. Anyhow, Mary, thank you for the call. Good, interesting topic. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom. This will probably be the last call since tomorrow you're going to be hard to get in touch with. So, or Monday anyway.
We're always going to be here, Tom.
Well, congratulations on your promotion, and we need to replicate you because you're the one that gets it. I just wanted to give you kudos for handling that one caller who was a typical classic townhall.com Ayn Randian type, trying to confuse the Federalist Papers, Hobbes and Locke and self-interest and democracy and constitution and just gobbledygook mixing it all up, and you just set him straight. And that is cracking the code, man. They are trying to make our constitution as if, you know, conflating capitalism and democracy, flipping it upside down, and trying to do all that with all these quotes from the Federalists, and from, they try to make Madison look like Hamilton. It's amazing, but we only have you to untangle all that.
Well, what's amazing, what's tragic, Tom, is that as a result of the war that was waged during Reagan's administration against the teaching of civics in public schools, you know, the whole idea, oh, my God, there's teachers out there who are union members. They must be socialists. We can't have them teaching. And now, you know, it's with David Horowitz, it's moved into our colleges because they got done what they wanted to get done in our high schools. And we, for all practical purposes, don't teach critical thinking skills, and we don't teach much of the history of the United States. It's more memorize these dates.
Yeah.
The tragedy is that probably 95% of our listeners had no idea what the difference, you know, who the people were that I was talking about. You know, who is Thomas Hobbes? Who is John Locke? Who is Jean-Jacques Rousseau?
Right.
And the Federalist Paper, what's that? And so, yeah, you know, I can't just do an hour on that. It would end up being a history lesson, but we try and bring these things into the show in little pieces over time and help people get it. And I'm so pleased that there's folks like you out there, Tom, who, you know, who find it of value and who are sharing the meme. It's really important.
Yeah, and it's all about the Republican Great Depression, man. And that's,
there you
got to remind people about that.
There you go. Thanks a lot, Tom. Bob in Los Angeles. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Oh, great to have you on. Good to see they got such a great replacement for Al.
Thank you, Bob. We have, by the way, about 30 seconds before we have to take a break. Quick
Turner Diaries you mentioned last segment.
Yes.
It's really ironic that Bush implemented the kinds of things that McVeigh thought that he'd get out of Clinton.
I know. Well, that was my point. Clinton said, Clinton said, no, we're not going to do this. We're just going to use police to track down the bad guy. And he did. And the people in Oklahoma City had closure. Bush, on the other hand, said, police, we don't need no stinking police. Afghanistan says, we'll hand bin Laden over to you if you'll actually hold a trial and, you know, in a court. And Bush says, no, we want to start bombing. I want to be a war president. And, you know, we're off to the races. I mean, it was just an absolute disaster. So, Bob, thank you very much for pointing that out and giving me an opportunity to actually close up that logic loop that I had opened and started and didn't wrap up. I mean, that's the point that people, you know, and the Republicans are terrified of this. Cheney at any chance will say, well, the Democrats just want to say it should be a police action. Yes, it should be. 45 minutes past the hour.
To confirm Ben Bernanke is the 14th chairman of the Federal Reserve.
Every breath you take, every change of rate, jobs you don't create, while we still stack fleet, I'll be watching you.
Oh, we're going to watch you, Ben.
Every single day, Bernanke takes my pay. When growth goes away, inflation will stay, and I'll be watching you. Oh, can't you see? The Fed's where I should be. I'm a poor heartache. Each of your mistakes.
Ah, yes, Ben Bernanke following in the footsteps of Alan Greenspan. We can't have workers drop below or go above a certain level of worker insecurity. We have to keep them insecure in order to not have wage inflation. Heavens. You know, it's no problem with wage inflation among CEOs, but workers? Big problem. Victoria Jones on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria, good morning, or afternoon, or whatever. It's afternoon there, isn't it?
Good day.
Good day. How are you? You always have the perfect answer.
There you go. So, yeah.
So how's everything in Washington, D.C. today? What's going on?
Well, it's below zero, and we've got ice. You know, we don't know what to do with it. We don't know how to deal with anything other than optimum conditions. And that's true politically as well as weather-wise.
Well, Bush is certainly not, he's not the recipient of optimum conditions. I'm curious, yesterday one of the reporters asked him if he had authorized the leak of Valerie Plame's name. And he said he was not going to answer the question. What would have happened if a White House reporter, had asked Bill Clinton about Monica Lewinsky, and he said, I'm not going to answer the question?
I think all hell would have broken loose, basically.
But why didn't all hell break loose yesterday?
Because that has been their policy now for, well, not for 3 years, because I remember when we asked that question 3 years ago, they were still asking the question for about 2.5 years now to not answer the question. And so we're at a point where we accept it because we know that the question will not be answered. But on a lighter note, I was talking to Peter Baker, the Washington Post correspondent who asked the question this morning, and he's quite missed because President Bush said following that, that because he didn't answer his question, he would recycle him and give him another shot at the question. And he didn't do so. He didn't follow through on his promise.
Bush lied and Peter lost? I see a bumper sticker.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Oh, my. Yeah. So there's 52 different investigations that the Democrats are holding in Washington, D.C. right now into possible crimes and misdemeanors by the Bush administration. We've got the Employee Free Choice Act here put forward. We've got, you know, budget issues. Nancy Pelosi, I guess, has backed off on her jet. She's flying commercial. I mean, there's a million things going on in Washington. Tom Tancredo is continuing to smoke his cigar. Any of these things worthy of note right now?
No, the only thing that seems to be worthy of note right now is what's going on in Iraq and what's going on in Afghanistan. And the president spoke this morning to the American Enterprise Institute, which I'm sure you would regard as a fair and impartial organization, Tom.
Yes, like frogs can fly, yeah.
Right, exactly. And spoke about the need for more troops, more money, more troops from NATO, which may be difficult to come by, and more money in Afghanistan, which will be easier to come by. And also he spoke about Iraq, but he didn't mention Iran, which I thought was fascinating. Iran, which is the drumbeat these days, was not mentioned once. In fact, I don't think I even heard the word Iran, which was quite extraordinary. But those are the things that are being talked about in Washington at the moment. All the other issues that you mentioned are not being talked about, certainly not by Republicans.
Yeah. And is this because there is a consensus that we're going to war in the next few months?
I'm not sure that there is a consensus on that. I mean, that may be the sense in the executive branch, but I don't think that those over on Capitol Hill want to go to war. I don't think Republicans on Capitol Hill want to go to war, for a number of reasons, including the fact that I think most of them think it's a very bad idea, and the other reason, which is that most of them have got mortgages and they'd like to keep paying them.
Yeah. So do you think that it's possible that Bush will be stopped from invading Iraq, or Iran, rather? Because it certainly sounds, you know, I don't think that he's planning a ground troop invasion, but it certainly sounded, you know, yesterday when he was talking about, I will protect the troops, we are sure that these weapons are coming from Iran. It did sound like he was getting ready to bomb the bejesus out of them or something like that.
It did sound like that, and the impression one has is that he does not think it necessary to go to Congress to get permission to do any kind of bombing raid, that he would regard the permission, if you like, that he'd already got from Congress for the war with Iraq as leading to action taken to bomb Iran. In other words, that something happening in Iran has arisen out of the conflict in Iraq and therefore is covered by the same resolution. I think that's exactly how he would view it. And so I don't think he would find it necessary to come to get any kind of permission from Congress. So for all that Hillary Clinton was very clear with him yesterday in warning him, I don't think it's going to do a bit of good.
Yeah, and yet you have, for example, Congressman Peter DeFazio putting forward legislation saying that he can't do that. He's got to come to Congress. Is that legislation going to get seriously considered?
I think that legislation very likely will get seriously considered. I think it very likely will. But then we also have signing statements.
Yeah, well, a ray of light and a little bit of darkness all at the same time. Victoria Jones. Yeah, indeed. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Victoria, thank you for being with us
today. Thank you.
It's always great talking with you. 56 minutes past the hour. In our next hour, the first war on terror. Thomas Jefferson was fighting it. We're going to talk with Larry Johnson about what's up with Iran, and we'll be taking your phone calls at 866-440-8466. Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
So is it really a war against Islamic terrorists? I mean, is that the bottom line, the sum total, the beginning and the end of it all? Is it all about George W. Bush's Islamo-fascists?
This nation is at war with Islamic fascists who will use any means to destroy those of us who love freedom.
Yeah, including getting our president to do away with our 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th amendments to the Constitution and habeas corpus and all kinds of things. But this is not the first time it's happened. David Smethurst is with us. He's the author of a book, an historical novel, sort of like Black Hawk Down. You know, it's a telestory, a brilliant historical story through the eyes of real character, or of characters based on real people. Tripoli is the title of the book, The United States' First War on Terror. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom. Good to be here.
Glad to have you with us. The first president to come into conflict with Muslims in the Middle East, actually it was in Northwest Africa, was Thomas Jefferson.
That's right. It was
Well, actually, it started off with Jefferson,
arguably, you could even say Adams, yeah.
Yeah, Adams first. Adams basically sent four consuls to maintain the peace with these four Muslim nations who basically were involved in state-sponsored terrorism. They charged any Christian nation an annual tribute to trade in the Mediterranean. And so Adams sent consuls to the Mediterranean to maintain the peace.
And then Jefferson became president and inherited this thing and ultimately went to war with these nations. And as you brilliantly describe in your book, you know, this whole charge up to Tripoli, it outnumbered 10 to 1, took that city and thus enshrining it in the song, you know, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, the Marine Corps hymn, isn't it?
That's right. Eventually, what, you know, to give you a little synopsis, what eventually happened was Jefferson, he had watched the pirates and watched them attack the United States. And what he did was he decided that his famous quote was, you have to fight force with force. And so what he decided to do was, while maintaining the peace, when Tripoli declared war on the United States, he sent a squadron of American ships and the U.S. Marines, which were founded shortly before the war, and he sent them to basically make a show of force so that showing both European nations and the Barbary pirates that they couldn't push around the United States.
Yeah, but there's a second lesson here, and that is that unlike George W. Bush, just, you know, hey, let the bombs drop, Jefferson never stopped pursuing diplomatic options.
That's correct. I mean, essentially, the Barbary War is an argument for diplomacy. What happened in the Barbary War was, you know, Adams sent four consuls or diplomats to the Barbary states, and they were Morocco, Tunis, Tripoli, and Algiers. And what happened was that America wasn't very strong. It had basically a small navy, a small Marine Corps. But more importantly, Adams and Jefferson understood that they really had to maintain diplomatic relations. And so while one of those states, Tripoli, declared war, the rest of the consuls, and one of those consuls was named William Eaton, who was really the big hero and larger-life character of the war, what he did...
And a hero in your book.
Yes, that's right. That's what the book's about. What he did was he kept maintaining the peace, even when Tunis, where he was a consul, sent out corsairs against American ships, even when there was saber-rattling in Morocco and Algiers. Those consuls held tight, and they held tough, and they kept maintaining the diplomatic relations so that the war didn't spread, that the United States had one enemy, Tripoli, and not four.
Yeah. The other thing that I find fascinating about comparing that era with this is that Adams used, to some extent, the XYZ affair. Now, this was France, not the Barbary pirates, but, you know, he had sent an ambassador to France after the French, or during the French Revolution, in the midst of the terrors. And there were three probably common criminals who tried to bribe or offered to bribe, said that they could set up a bribe or a favorable situation with the French government on behalf of the Americans. And Adams whipped up a war hysteria around this. In fact, the newspapers described him as being manly. And there was real concern that we would go to war with France around that time. Jefferson calmed that down when he came into office. But Madison used that in part as an excuse to pass the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, which and then throw into prison 20 newspaper publishers, all who by coincidence had run editorials criticizing Adams. He was throwing his political opponents in jail. In fact, he threw Matthew Lyon, the congressman from Vermont, into prison for speaking out on the floor of the House against him. On the other hand, Jefferson comes into office. He does away with, well, the acts actually expired the day that he came into office in March 4th, 1800, and comes into office, apologizes to all these guys, lets them out of jail, reimburses them, repays them, and says, you know, democracy is stronger than this. We don't need to do away with the Constitution in order to maintain democracy. And even in the midst of the war with the Barbary pirates, this war with radical Islam of that time, Jefferson is not suspending habeas corpus or doing away with the constitutional protections. And then the president who followed him, Madison, the country gets invaded by the British and the Canadians. They take the White House and they burn it. And James Madison doesn't say, oh, we need to do away with the Fourth Amendment and start, you know, reading people's mail. And we need to do away with the Fifth Amendment and be able to just capture people like Jose Padilla and put them in prison for 4 years and torture them. And Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, you know, and on it goes. These guys actually respected the ideals of democracy.
You're right. They respected the ideals of democracy, and I think, importantly, I think Jefferson was a very smart president. And when he conducted the war, not only did he maintain diplomatic relations and really promote that, but what he also did was he did some other different things. He put some pressure on Tripoli, and that was he basically authorized an unconventional war against Tripoli to put a little pressure on them to go to the negotiating table and agree to some terms that the United States would find favorable. What happened in the Tripoli War was the United States lost one of its finest ships, the USS Philadelphia, 307 men imprisoned in a dungeon in Tripoli. So Jefferson's back was against the wall. He could have escalated this. He could have sent a lot more ships, a lot more troops, and really gone to war. What he did was he said to William Eaton, who was the former consul, go raise an army, find the brother of the ruler of Tripoli, march across 500 miles of desert, and attack the pirate fortress of Derna. In the meantime, what he did was he authorized Tobias Lear, the U.S. consul general in the Mediterranean, he said to him, go negotiate with Tripoli, see if we can get a deal. And you know what? He got it. Jefferson was a pretty smart guy, not only from a government point of view, but from a military and a diplomatic point of view as well.
So in the modern world, it would have been the equivalent of sort of taking hostage a couple of Saddam Hussein really was a bad guy and we were after him. I mean, unfortunately, it was Osama bin Laden. Somehow Bush mixed that all up. But it would be the equivalent of taking one of Saddam Hussein's brothers hostage, and at the same time saying, hey, you know, we've got some carrots we're willing to offer you. We've got this stick. We have your brother here. We're going to, you know, take him out or one of your cities, and let's talk.
Well, his brother, actually, Hamet Karamanli, was overthrown by the brother. These guys were ruthless. So there was the Basha, or the ruler of Tripoli, was named Yusuf, and he actually killed his older brother and removed Hamet from power.
So what Jefferson did in that invasion was what? What did he accomplish in that?
What he ended up accomplishing was, for $40,000, he sent Eaton, and Eaton raised an army. Eaton was able to find Hamet Karamanli in Egypt, and he marched and put some pressure on Yusuf to actually negotiate.
So this would be like finding one of the exiled brothers of Saddam Hussein and saying,
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, I get it. Yeah.
But it's a fascinating use of fighting force with force, but using the right amount of force to get the right results. And what's interesting about this war is it didn't end with a peace treaty in 1805. It continued sometime after that and ultimately ended also in diplomacy with a touch of force.
Yeah, and because what he saw, what Jefferson saw, and what, frankly, presidents throughout American history have seen, is that the use of force is the end point of a political process. And it represents the failure, ultimately, of a political process, and it can be used to try to bring us back to a political process, but it's all part of a spectrum that is essentially political and diplomatic. And Bush seems to have separated these things.
Exactly. I mean, you know, one of the analogies I like to use is if you think about the Barbary States in 1799, and then you think about sort of the Axis of Evil, speech in 2002, where essentially the United States is identifying enemies. But for all those enemies, Iraq, North Korea, Iran, either we don't have diplomatic relations still with them, or we never engage them. So it's very different.
So we identified them as enemies, but we never identified what our goal was.
Exactly.
For them. And that's what virtually every other president has done, and what you so brilliantly outline how Jefferson handled it in your book, Tripoli, the United States' First War on Terror, David Smethurst, TripoliBook.com, the website. And it's going to be a movie?
It'll be a movie. It's Ridley Scott and William Monahan have done the screenplay, and it'll be coming out sometime later this year.
Great. David, thanks for being with us. 16 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the True People's Radio, Tom Hartman radio program. George W. Bush at his news conference yesterday going on and on and on about, yes, we've got it all figured out. It's the Iranians.
Critics say that you are using the same quality of intelligence about Iran that you used to make the case for war in Iraq, specifically about WMD, that turned out to be wrong. and that you are doing that to make a case for war against Iran. Is that the case?
I can say with certainty that the Quds Force, a part of the Iranian government, has provided these sophisticated IEDs that have harmed our troops. And I'd like to repeat, I do not know whether or not the Quds Force was ordered from the top echelons of government, but my point is, what's worse, them ordering it and it happening, or them not ordering it and it's happening? And so we will continue to protect our troops.
Now, the question by David Gregory of NBC was, are you ginning up a war against Iran, essentially?
To be wrong. And that you are doing that to make a case for war against Iran.
Is that the case? Larry Johnson, former Central Intelligence Agency and U.S. State Department officer with the Department of Counterterrorism, an expert in the fields of terrorism, aviation security, crisis, and risk management. His website and his blog over at noquarter.typepad.com is on the line with us. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom.
Good to hear from you again. Good to talk with you again. Bush didn't even answer the question. He was asked straight up by David Gregory, are you trying to gin up a war with Iran? And he did not say no.
He should have said yes, because that's exactly what's going on. They are setting the table for this. I mean, what was so curious about this sudden focus on Iran is that, you know, I don't know if President Bush has been asleep for the last 4 years. Some would make that case. But Iran has been involved on the ground in supporting various Shia elements since March, April of 2003. Mm-hmm. So it's like, where's the beef?
Yeah, I mean, this is nothing new. And, you know, the metaphor that I keep using is if China was to look at the United States and say, you know, the New York Times published evidence when they actually counted the vote in Florida that Bush was not elected president, that he didn't win Florida in the 2000 election. So, you know, that was a coup d'etat. He shouldn't be there as president. Number two, he's violating his own constitution. Number three, he's arresting people illegally. He's torturing people. He's running concentration camps. He has weapons of mass destruction. He has used them, particularly things like depleted uranium in other countries. We're going to invade America and liberate the Americans. If China did that, I'd be out in the streets shooting at the Chinese troops.
Right.
And I would be calling my friends in Canada saying, you got any weapons? I mean, why would we not expect, when 80% of the Iraqis say that in their mind it's acceptable to shoot at Americans because we're illegally occupying their country, why would it be unreasonable to expect that they would be going to other nearby countries in the region and saying, help us out?
Yeah, no, that shouldn't be a surprise. I mean, what's going on here, though, is the misuse of intelligence. It is telling us a truth that the Iranians are involved in Iraq. It's telling us the truth that armaments, which have some links back to Iran, have been used to kill our troops, but it's being used as propaganda and a lie because it's got the twist. It suggests and implies that most of the troops, most of the casualties caused by these weapons, you know, that's at the fault of the Iranians. When in fact, when you look at the actual casualty figures, the ones that they say are linked to the Iranians is less than 8%. So we've got 92% of the killed and wounded of U.S. forces in Iraq. Where does that lie? Well, you know, that tends to point more in the direction of Saudi Arabia and Jordan.
Yeah, and in fact, the Saudis have been running private Saudi citizens have been renting TV time and auditoriums to do fundraisers where they've raised, in one case, $25 million to buy things like shoulder-fired surface-to-air anti-aircraft missiles. And this was reported by the Associated Press in December. I had the story here. I read it to share it with our listeners a couple days ago or last week. And that's not even being mentioned now.
No, and they also ignore the fact that most of the pushback is coming from Iraqis, indigenous Iraqis, that tend to be Sunnis. They're in Al-Anbar province, Ramadi, Fallujah, Tal Afar. And that's where the bulk of the casualties that the U.S. has incurred. Now, what Bush is not telling the American people, and this is why I said he's setting the table for war, that within the past month and a half, we have seen at least two occasions where U.S. forces have captured Iranians, some who were identified as diplomats by the Iraqis themselves, saying, hey, these are Iranian diplomats here. And then yesterday on the border with Afghanistan, although it's on the opposite side from Iraq, you had 18 Iranian Revolutionary Guard killed in a bomb. The Iranians are going to assume that the United States is now starting to attack them, and they will retaliate. These guys take an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth to a new level.
This is an honor society.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, we saw that with the shoot down of the Iranian Airbus back in the 1980s. There's very strong indications suggesting that Iran at least hired Libya to do the job of blowing up Panam 103.
Yeah. So you're quite certain that Bush is preparing for a war with
Iran. This will not be a war of preemption. This will be cast as a war of retaliation. And when it's done in that term, you know, most members of Congress are going to feel compelled that, oh, we got to go along with the president because our troops are being attacked.
That's
so
terrible.
It's very misleading. It's very deceptive, and it's very dangerous.
Larry Johnson, noquarter.tightpad.com. Larry, thanks for being with us
today.
Hey,
Tom. Good to be with you, man.
Always good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back to Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Time to take a look at what's going on with the crazies of the world.
With condescending tribes making money selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts. I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic, cunts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi.
That's right.
I really am, because I'm a Nazi.
Oh, yes, it's our Rush alert, and I apologize. I shouldn't call him crazy. He's, you know, he's got a few challenges, but he's actually talented. Yeah. Well, okay, so our intro music here for our Rush alert. Here it is, our Limbaugh moment.
Said your mother was white, your father was African, you're raised in a white household, yet at some point you decided you were black.
I'm not sure I decided it. You know, if you look African American in this society, you're treated as an African American, and when you're a child in particular, that is how you begin to identify yourself.
We conclude here that he didn't define himself as black, that the way he looks does. I'm not sure I decided it. Well, if you didn't decide it, then how did it happen? Well, just when you look like that, that's what you are. Well, renounce it then. If it's not something you want to be, if you didn't decide it, renounce it. Become white.
Yeah.
What a great idea. In closing, let me say that each and every day, I'm an evil, rotten, egotistical snob. I'm the copper, the cop of Joe McCarthy-like Gestapo, the right-wing, foam-at-the-mouth, jack-booted slob, the democratic trasher, years of liberal bashing with the equivalent compassion of a Trump.
Well, enough already. Okay. It's tragic. It's just tragic. Trashing people because of their race. Trashing people because the whole feminazi. It's just tragic. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number. Dave in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Tom, I've been on hold with you almost since your national program came on the air.
I'm sorry, Dave.
I didn't know if you could see me, but
anyway. I can.
Huh?
I can. It's been a busy day. What's up?
Well, we're now hearing that Iran is becoming a threat, and it's George is going to protect our troops by some crazy action. So what we're hearing from most of your callers, most people, is in crazy, a moron, stupid, insane. But, well, you're making it known, and I guess some of your callers are, that this is something that goes back an awful long way. That it's got to do with their planned axis of evil, their new world order, their global domination thing. So that's been around for a long time. So what I'm saying is that this is the planned behavior of some serious, I use the word psychopathic, but hardcore criminals who want to grab what they can and don't care how many people they hurt along the way.
Well, as I recall, Dave, you're a licensed clinical psychologist. Is that a diagnosis?
I have been, and I am retired. I am not currently licensed, but I would say that psychopathic is a term that I would be inclined to throw over them, yes.
Yeah. A lot of people have died as a result of these guys' behavior.
This is hardcore criminals of a type. I think you could go through prisons all over the country and not find anything like this.
Amazing. Dave, thank you for the call. It's It's chilling to think about, frankly. Steve in Denver, Colorado. Steve, welcome.
Tom Hartman?
Indeed.
Oh, it's a real, real privilege to talk with you. Before I get to my point, I really loved your book, Unequal Protection.
Oh, thank you.
I've read it many times. I use it, and I'd love to talk to you more in depth. Your previous guest before the last one was talking about Thomas Jefferson and the Barbary Coast Pirates.
Yes.
I was wondering, and I don't know if you have the answer, if he'd ever used this one clause from the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, I guess it's Clause Number 10, I look at my Constitution here, where Congress is given the power to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and
right.
offenses against the law of nations.
Right.
To me, that's one of the most important clauses in the Constitution for the present use, because to me,
right.
that's...
And Jefferson acquired that authority from Congress, by the way, when he went against the Barbary Pirates.
That is absolutely proper, because that says to me that when you get to a question of, you know, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist, the question becomes who is supposed to make that definition. And I think the Constitution is quite clear that's the Congress and not the president that makes
you're
the determination of who is and who is not a terrorist.
You're absolutely right. The president is not the decider. When Bush said things like...
war in Iraq, I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
And
so I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation, but I'm the decider, and I decide what is best.
He's wrong.
He's absolutely wrong.
We the people are the deciders, and we decide on our elected representatives, and they have the constitutional power to be the deciders about issues of war and peace, not the president.
And once they decide, then the president is the one that carries those decisions out, yes.
That's
but
correct.
He
He's
is
the commander-in-chief of the military.
As commander-in-chief, I don't think... Is continually operative. It becomes operative once we are in a state of war.
That's correct. And in fact, the Constitution even goes further in Article 8 or Section 8 of Article 1 of the Constitution even goes further to say that no authorization, no funding for war can last more than 2 years. It has to be continuously revisited by Congress. They wanted to make sure that the president was kept on a tight leash. They were very unambiguous about that. Steve, thank you for the call and bringing up the issue. John in Phoenix. Hey, John.
Listening
on KPHX.
I had a question I wanted to ask the author, but I guess he's not there. But maybe if you know anything about this. My understanding, if I remember my history correct, is that one of the treaties involved in the Tripoli situation, in the treaty it states, the United States is not a Christian nation. Because
yes, that's the opening sentence, actually. The opening sentence of the treaty with Tripoli. And that was signed by Adams, although it was worked out during the George Washington administration. And in all probability, nobody's really sure, but in all probability, the actual author of that was James Madison. And that treaty preceded all of these conflicts. I mean, that was the first attempt to work things out with the Barbary Pirates.
Okay, I just wanted to bring that up because every time I listen to, you know, right-wing radio, it's always, da-da-da, United States is a Christian nation, and we've got, you know, a document signed by most of the founding fathers having some involvement that's saying, no, wait a minute, we're not.
Yeah, no, this is a treaty that was ratified by Congress. It was submitted, it may have been at the end of Washington's administration, because the official story is that George Washington wrote the Treaty of Tripoli. In point of fact, you know, historically, most of what George Washington has attributed to him as being written by him was actually written by James Madison, who was kind of his friend and ghostwriter, and was, you know, passed through Congress, and, but, you know, by the time John Adams became president, and Adams was the one who signed it as president, and like I said, this was all about 4 years before Jefferson had to confront this issue. But, absolutely. The opening sentence of the treaty with Tripoli, as America is in no way a Christian nation, starts right out that way. Good point. Tom in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Tom, listening on WPTT. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hey.
Hello?
Yes, indeed. You're on the air. What's up?
Yes, I want to talk about Social Security money. It seems that I read in places that the government has been taking out the money from Social Security and have been using it for all sorts of things that they have not accounted for. And then they wrote IOUs into the Social Security account, which they never intend to pay back.
Yeah. Let me give you the whole story in a quick nutshell, Tom, and thank you for the call and for bringing it up. Back in the early 1980s, this really started the tail end of the Carter administration. They realized that there was this rabbit going to be going through the python called the baby boomer generation, all these people retiring. Up until that point, Social Security, from its creation in 1935 or 1936 until 1980, Social Security had always been a pay-as-you-go system. There was no trust fund. There was no surplus. There was no bank account. If Social Security was paying out $700 million, billion-dollar, whatever, $700 million in benefits in 1942, then the tax was fixed to the rate that it would generate $700 million in income. So it was a pay-as-you-go system where the working generation was always paying for the retirement of their parents, of the retired generation. When they saw that the baby boomers were coming along, there was this huge lump coming down the road. The Greenspan and Daniel Patrick Moynihan Commission got together and they said, we got to do something about this. Let's make the baby boomers be the first generation in history since Social Security was started that not only pay for their parents' retirement, but also pay for their own retirement by doubling the Social Security tax, which Reagan signed. Doubled the tax on working people, people who at the time made up to $35,000 a year. Doubled that tax and take the surplus of that, the half that is not needed right now to pay for the retirement of our parents, and set that aside in a trust fund that will then begin drawing down around 2012, 2014. And it was a good idea, I guess, and we started doing it. And then Reagan did his Reaganomics and discovered, holy cow, I did all these tax cuts. I took us from top 70% rate that Kennedy had down to 29%, and all of a sudden the government has no revenue. And Greenspan says, well, you know, you can borrow from the Social Security Trust Fund, and it won't show up on the books. It won't look like you have a deficit. And so Reagan started borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund to make it look good, and every president since then has continued. So, yes, there's, in fact, George Bush himself is going to borrow, has borrowed over $1 trillion from the Social Security Trust Fund and is projecting another $1 trillion of borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund to so-called balance his budget. And, you know, it's a small problem, just a small problem, 45 minutes past the hour.
Now there are rumors in the camp about our enemy. They say that when you see him, he looks just like you and me. But you deny it, Sergeant, and you are a man of war. So you must give me lessons, for I've never killed before.
And welcome back to Talk Radio for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Ian in San Francisco, California, listening on the Quake.
Hey,
Ian.
How you doing? Listen, I wanted to just say something about how we ought to be careful in this case of Iran. In particular, you know, most of us on the radio, listening to the radio right now, don't speak Farsi.
Right.
So what we're being told that the president of Iran has said may or may not be true. So, for instance, it said that he denies the Holocaust. And he may. He may. I don't know. But what I do know is I saw him interviewed by Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes. And he was asked about this. And the way he put it was, if it happened, who did it? And his point was, of course, that the Germans did it. And then his next point was, well, who should pay for this, the Palestinians or the Germans? Not a bad question.
What he's doing is he's speaking to his local audience, basically.
Well, that may be.
I mean, you know,
questioning
the Holocaust is something that is very, very widespread in the Middle East.
And
I've worked in the Middle
that.
East, and
I appreciate
I've traveled throughout the Middle East.
My point, though, is this: part of being the drumbeat for war is alleged claims about what he has said or hasn't said. All being said, of course, in a language we don't speak.
And it doesn't, frankly, ultimately matter what he says. What matters is what he does.
Well, here's what matters, though. Things are being said, for instance. When I look on the web, I find different interpretations in terms of the language of what he has said. For instance, it is said that he has said that Israel and the United States should be wiped off the map.
Yeah, and
when I read the interpretations that I'm finding, he isn't saying that. He's saying something much closer to there should be regime change in those countries.
Yeah.
Now,
no, I,
so what I'm
I,
saying
I,
is,
I get it, Ian. No, okay. I get it. And your point is you know spot on. But let me even take it a step further, and that is that it's not about what Ahmadinejad says. The guy doesn't have any power. He lost hugely in the last elections. If we just left him alone, he would implode. He was doing his whole Holocaust conference because he thought it would help with the elections coming up. He thought he would play to the right wingers in Iran. He thought he would play to racism in Iran. It didn't work. It didn't work for him. He is on the out, and frankly, it's the reformers who are coming in, and we're playing into his hand, just like we played into Bin Laden's hand by making him Lex Luthor, by making him the hyper villain, so that George Bush can be Superman. And it's a tragedy. It's not a good thing. It doesn't work. Speaking of the Holocaust, Steve in Springfield, Massachusetts. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing? I want to get away from the radio. Listen, I hate to just react to a previous caller, but I don't know if you'd agree with me. I just want to put to rest this canard that only Germany is responsible for the Holocaust. I'm certainly not saying Germany, who, by the way, out of all the European nations who participated in the Holocaust with great fervor, only Germany has made reparations. I think the Germans have been, in a lot of ways, the fall guys.
Sure, and you can argue that the Poles, you know, where you had Auschwitz and Czechoslovakia, where you had I forget the name of the camp there, and even
but may
the
I,
Dutch, you know.
May I, I'm sorry sure. to interrupt, but may I address Palestine?
Sure.
We must remember that the leader of the Palestinians, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, was a staunch ally of Hitler, visited concentration camps and asked the SS why they were not stepping up the exterminations. Many of the Palestinians, not all, many were
Steve, I'm liberty. You're way beyond my level of knowledge in that area, and I'm not. We're dancing around the edge of getting into this. Who's right and who's wrong in the Middle East? And it's a debate that goes on forever, and I'm not gonna do it right now. I mean, there's a time and place for it, but not right now. Particularly with a minute and a half left to go on the show. Sharon, Linwood, Washington. Hey, Sharon.
Well, hi. I just wanted to ask about Andy Stern, I think his name is, who is the head of the SEIU. And
yeah.
He broke away from AFL-CIO, and shortly after that, Robert Kennedy on Ring of Fire said he is dangerous and very conservative, and he didn't really care for him, or he was afraid of him or not afraid of him. But
mm-hmm.
Do you know anything about that?
I've interviewed Andy Stern. I've somewhat sparred with him. I've read his book. Andy Stern is probably semi-libertarian, in my opinion. I'm not sure how he'd describe himself, but he's far more conservative than traditional union leaders. But, you know, on the other hand, SEIU is a union. I mean, that puts you in a fairly good position to start out with, and it's the fastest-growing union in the United States. I would much rather highlight my parallels, and I think we all should, and similarities with Andy Stern and the areas where we agree than the areas where we disagree. I just think that, you know, beating up on the guy, particularly right now when the union movement is on the ropes, is not a good idea. Cher, thanks a lot for the call. Art in Seattle. Hey, Art.
Yeah, Tom, I've just lost my voice. I'll try again tomorrow.
Okay, no problem. Lee in Duval, Washington. Hey, Lee.
Hey, Tom. I was watching CNN last night. They were having a panel there. Soledad O'Brien was leading it. They were talking about Mitt Romney being launching his Republican campaign for president in the front of the Henry Ford Museum.
You're kidding. The Henry Ford Museum? I knew he was in Dearborn, but, you know, Henry Ford was a Nazi.
That's what she says. I didn't know that. I didn't know he was an anti-Semite. Well, she didn't know.
Oh,
probably doesn't know Prescott Bush was. William
yeah.
Randolph Hearst, the head of the...
Henry Ford founded a newspaper in Dearborn specifically to spread anti-Semitic propaganda. I mean, that's... Of course, I grew up in Michigan. I thought everybody in Michigan knew that. Anyhow, coming up on tomorrow's program, the top news of the day, plus Senator Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie. Alex Epstein and I are going to take opposite sides on whether the sick and in need are entitled to health care, and our on-the-air book, Cracking the Code. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.